On this episode of the DFA podcast, Ryan and I talk all things Cleveland Indians as they win their 21st game in a row. Hear about their processes, their best moves, and our favorite, Giovanni Urshela. It's all here on the DFA podcast.
And welcome to episode 30 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, joined as always by RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, we are recording in the midst of a historic streak, and we're going to talk about it. How does that sound?
I don't know which historic streak you're talking about because, you know, is it the end of a historic streak of you correctly pronouncing CBS Sports, or are we talking about the Indians winning their 21st game in a row?
I think both are equally important, and we should share an equal amount of time to each of them. What do you think?
Yeah, so we're always going to start with the Sports one. Yes, definitely check out all the good work at CBS Sports. We are like the Onion spinoff of CBS Sports, and that's an appropriate place for my articles. But no, the Indians, they have not lost in a long time, and they are going to top the Moneyball A's American League record of 20 wins in a row, and at this point, you kind of have to think that they're going to continue to win until the cows come home, right? Like, that's the end of the show. We just agree that they're never going to lose again, and that's that, right?
Thank you very much for joining us. You can follow the DFA podcast on Twitter. And no, I mean, I agree with you. It seems like they're invincible at this point. We are, as we record this, we're in the bottom of the seventh. The Indians are up 4-3 over Detroit, and you know, thanks to Jay Bruce, it looks like they've got a 21st win on the horizon. It's astonishing to see a team rip off any sort of streak, to me, over 10 games, let alone twice that many up to 21. You know, no matter how good a team is, it's always surprising. So it's probably a good idea to talk about not just the performance that's happening on the field for the Indians, but since we are ostensibly a transaction podcast, we should talk a little bit about how the team was built and how they're having so much success, maybe a little bit more from a process standpoint, right?
Yeah, and in general, I want to say that I find the Indians and their front office interesting. Earlier this year, I wrote an article about how teams are starting to hire prospect writers. And I shouldn't say start. They have already been in the process of hiring prospect writers. And, you know, the Indians featured prominently in that article because they've hired so many writers. And, you know, I went through a list when I was writing that piece. And I mean, there's like a dozen different writers, at least a dozen different writers in that front office, and including like a guy like Matt Foreman, who is their assistant general manager. Mm-hmm. Well, you can find his articles on lacrosse online still. Like, he's that fresh from writing. And, you know, there's a number of scouts like Ethan Purser and Stefan Segui and all them. But the point I'm trying to make here is I find the Indians front office interesting for that reason, and also because of the challenges they face of trying to build and sustain a winner in a smaller market on a smaller payroll. And also, like, it was just like 5 years ago that the Indians looked like they were, I don't want to say like passed by, but they were no longer considered the smartest team in baseball. They were no longer considered one of the smartest teams in baseball because of the results. And, you know, you looked at their record versus their payroll expectations. I believe Tom Tangle had a formula out there for expected wins based solely on payroll, and they were overperforming that. But they'd went years between playoff appearances, you know, from 2008 to 2012, they didn't make a single playoff appearance, and they only had one winning season during that stretch. And, you know, unfortunately for them, that was a time when the Rays were doing really well. That was a time when the A's were starting to come back in style, the Pirates were ascending, and, you know, they kind of got passed by on the small market success scale. And now they're like the model franchise, I think, or one of the model franchises, because, hey, they found a winning formula again. They're going to have a winning record. Or they've already, you know, guaranteed they're going to have a winning record for the fifth year in a row. And you look at the roster, and more so perhaps than any other team, it seems like they have found a way to consistently make smart, if at the time unheralded, trades to acquire these talented players.
Yeah, I think that's something that's worth talking about. So let's kind of get into the specifics first, and then maybe a little bit later we'll peel back a little bit and we'll talk a little bit more about process. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about those few unheralded deals or the smaller deals that have kind of built this team out. There have been mistakes in with the good successes. I think that's undeniable. But it seems like almost always when they make a small deal, they come out ahead in it. Whether that's the acquisitions of big time superstars like Corey Kluber, or whether it's even just adding someone like Yan Gomes, who was a very productive player for a while, may not necessarily be a very productive player now. But so what are a couple of those deals that you see as the most indicative of how this team was able to be built?
Well, I think Kluber is obviously number one because, obviously, I would say, because I don't want to necessarily include Carlos Carrasco here because he was acquired in like a real rebuilding move. So I feel a little uncomfortable saying that like this is a sign of their wherewithal when it comes to evaluating players. I think Edwin Jackson kind of fits their opportunism. Same with Andrew Miller, where they took advantage of a good situation. I think Brandon Guyer, even though he's having a bad season, was another sign of that where, and even Jay Bruce, you can throw him in there too. Those have been examples where they take advantage of the situation presented to them. They take advantage of the market. I guess the one situation where I might highlight is a situation that actually had nothing to do with making a trade. It might have had more to do with not making a trade. And that was Jose Ramirez. Because if you remember, when he came up, and this was before Francisco Lindor came up and claimed shortstop as his own throne, Ramirez had a good little run as a rookie. And then, Lindor came up and he kind of got lost in the shuffle and he didn't perform well. And all of a sudden last season, they had a couple injuries, a couple underperformances, and Ramirez was thrown back out there and he took off. And they signed him to that extension this winter. And I guess that's the move part right there is the extension itself, because that was a risky extension.
Oh, no question. He's not a guy who had a huge track record of performance, prospects. He doesn't have the size that people might have initially wanted from a player of his degree. So it's certainly a risk. It's the kind of those risky extensions that teams make, but this one has absolutely worked out for him.
Yeah, and he's been fantastic. And it was funny because when they signed that extension, realistically, I was thinking he's probably a second division third baseman, maybe a super utility guy. We're talking about him now as an MVP candidate. And that is one of the best deals in baseball from a team perspective. I know Michael Bauman will get mad if I say that's one of the best deals in baseball, period, because it's very unfriendly to Ramirez, although within a baseball context, to be fair, because I think all of us would sign that contract if we
Of
could.
course.
And some of the other deals they made, like, okay, I'm just going to throw this one out there. And I realize that it's kind of, stupid to highlight middle relievers on a team this good, but Nick Goody, I mean, Nick Goody, nobody knew who Nick, I mean, people might have known who Nick Goody was because of a name, but nobody cared about Nick Goody. And
Well,
you look at his
let's.
numbers this season. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, let's put this in perspective. Nick Goody, when acquired by the Indians, did not rate a transaction analysis at Beyond the
Yeah.
Box at Baseball Prospectus.
And of course, anything can happen in 50 relief innings. So, this is not to hate on Brian for not covering Nick Goody, but let's just read his numbers this season. In 49 and two-thirds innings, he has a 2.72 ERA. He has allowed 3.6 walks per nine, 6.3 hits per nine. He has struck out 12.1 batters per nine. I mean, that's pretty impressive. And then, Dan Otero, again, he's not really a huge deal. He's a middle reliever. Like, you don't want him pitching at the end of your games or whatever. Okay, well, Otero, in just about two full seasons with the Indians now, has a 2.07 ERA, a 4.89 strikeout to walk ratio. Doesn't really strike out enough batters to work in high leverage. But, just small signings like that, that can really help your bullpen because it allows you to better leverage your high leverage relievers. It allows them to kind of plan for the seventh through ninth. They don't have to worry about, well, do we have to bring in, another high leverage reliever? Do we have to bring him in a little earlier, what have you? So, the cascading effect there is fascinating. And I mean, even guys like Zach McAllister, who was, developed by them and whatnot, he's been really good out of the bullpen and he was a failed starter. So it seems like, and maybe this is just, me misreading situation. Maybe they just got lucky. And I do want to talk about the role that luck plays in team building. But it seems like they're pretty good at evaluating these, I guess I would say, fringe talents, or, you know, they're not just evaluating superstars here. They're getting calls right on fringe talents who are coming in and producing way above their heads. And you can, again, you can credit some of that to luck. You can credit some of that to just good timing or what have you. But that's a very important skill for a team. And even if guys like Goody and Otero disappear once the postseason rolls around, you have to have those kind of success stories to make it to the postseason, at least in most cases.
Yeah, no question. And so we can talk a little bit more about the bullpen in a minute, because I think that their approach to building a bullpen has been successful. Well, the results have certainly been successful, but their approach has been interesting. And I want to talk about Terry Francona's role in that, too. But just to throw out another name, a name that I say probably too often on this podcast, another small move that really has paid off for them this year is Mike Clevinger. You know, when the Indians acquired him from the Angels, they dealt away Vinny Pestano, who was at the time one of their kind of foundational building block pieces in their bullpen. He had been going through a bit of a downturn, but he was still, you know, part of the original Indians bullpen triumvirate of, I think it was, they called it something like the bullpen mafia with Pestano and Cody Allen, and I think Brian Shaw came in a little bit later. And you know, it really kind of was one of those acquisitions where Clevinger wasn't a very heralded prospect, and the Indians seemed to be able to develop pitching with a little bit better consistency, I would say, than a lot of other teams. They tend to always have another starting pitcher or swingman who is effective enough, at least for a little while. You saw that with guys like Cody Anderson and Ryan Merritt for a little while. They always seem to be able to build up some depth, and I think part of that is some of these savvy acquisitions that they make in these smaller trades.
I would agree with that. And I mean, just to throw out another name who was acquired in a small trade this year, Joe Smith. He's came back from Toronto, and he's only thrown 13 and two-thirds innings, but he hasn't walked a batter, hasn't allowed a home run, hasn't really allowed many hits. So that's just another, you know, smart, savvy little get. And I guess that makes, you know, I guess that makes sense that they would be able to get success from these guys, because, you know, most winning teams, they have some unforeseen seasons that pop up. And I guess what we have to talk about is how much of the Indian success with some of these bit trades, some of these smaller acquisitions, how much of that do you credit to luck versus how much of that do you credit to skill, or are we unqualified to really make that distinction?
Well, I'm certainly unqualified to make that distinction, but I will try anyway. And my guess is that this is more about process and good decision making than it is luck, but luck is a not insignificant part of it. You know, the teams that make these kinds of moves always seem to know their own players better than the opposing team, or they always seem to know their own players better than somebody in the public sphere. So I give them credit for that. But I think the success rate on this team has been so high, and especially when it comes to pitchers, that I think there has to be some sort of method behind the madness that is helping them make these, you know, decisions and have it work out in their favor. I mean, if you look at it, Carrasco, Bauer, Clevinger, acquiring Andrew Miller, they gave up a lot of talent in return. All of a sudden, Justice Sheffield looks like he could be a very, very legitimate middle of the rotation to front of the rotation starter, but Miller didn't exactly fall apart when they got him. He was enough to bring him most of the way to a championship last year. I have to think there is something in their process, but I'm probably unqualified to say exactly what that is.
I am going to throw this out there. I kind of hinted at it earlier. I think patience and discipline are two things that are very big in their process that maybe other teams don't necessarily have, at least not to the extent that Cleveland has it. Because just to go through some names you mentioned, Carrasco, remember it took a move to the bullpen for him to really find himself.
No question.
Bauer's probably kind of overrated, excuse me, because I feel like a guy with that stuff should be much better than his career numbers are. However, to his credit, he's pitching well this season. And again, that's an instance of patience, right? Because it would have been easy to give up on him at any point over the last few years. Clevinger, even, I mean, he didn't really look like he would be this dominating. And I know the walks are still there and all. But again, that's a case where they were patient with him and they didn't necessarily give up on him. And the same goes for the position player side of things. You know, Ramirez or even Lonnie Chisenhall. I think he would have been justified to give up on him at various points. They didn't, and it's paid off for them. And, you know, we didn't even talk about Jay Bruce as a savvy little acquisition. He was, though. They had a hole open up, and they plug him in, and, you know, he gave him a different dimension, and he's been, you know, fine. And like you said, he hit the big home run today. So I think patience is a thing. And, you know, I think one of the things that's underrated in the public sphere when it comes to some of these trades is that fatigue is a real thing.
Right.
You know, you hear this talked about with the Rays trading Tim Beckham. They just got kind of tired of dealing with that situation. And not even because Beckham was irritating or whatever, but like at some point the shine kind of wears off. You know, the honeymoon phase ends and, you know, you're just like, you know what, this is not going to work here for whatever reason. Let's move on. Well, the Indians have done a very good job of avoiding that fatigue factor, and they have paid, I mean, their ability to avoid that has paid dividends over and over and over, it seems like.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I think there might be an element to it that goes back to their issues with payroll and their issues with, I won't say, they've made some poor decisions in terms of the free agent market in the past, most notably the Bourne and Swisher contracts, which were a real anchor around them for a few years. A lot of teams who are smaller payroll tend to make a lot of little moves with core type players, it seems like, maybe more frequently than the Indians have or have chosen to. Because I look at other teams like the Rays, and I look at other small market teams like the Athletics, and these are smart teams. These are teams that are always looking for arbitrage, but they are constantly tinkering in a way that the Indians don't seem to be.
Yeah, and I was gonna mention the A's because, you know, you talked about, I mean, you know, the A's have changed the roster entirely. What, 3 years, 2 years?
Right. I don't know if there's a benefit to maybe keeping some of these same folks around, giving them more of a more leash and more time to develop. Maybe from a player development standpoint, this is what some of these smaller market teams should be considering rather than the, you know, not quite Jerry DePoto, but pretty close thing that Billy Beane's been doing recently, which is flipping guys in and out and trying to get a little tweak here and there that'll get them an extra half a win above a replacement or something.
Yeah, and I wonder if you've almost just touched on what clubhouse chemistry actually is.
Wow. And,
well, think about it, though. Maybe it's not necessarily keeping a group of guys together and having them gel and, you know, achieve synergy that way. Maybe it's really about keeping guys together, allowing them to become really comfortable in their environment and comfortable with the people around them. And then you get the best performance from them because of that comfort level. I mean, these are human beings. And, you know, just speaking, I mean, look at this podcast. When we first started, we were awful. Now we're slightly better because we're used to dealing with each other. You know, we kind of picked up on each other's ticks and whatnot. And, you know, throw Brody in there if he ever returns to us. I guess the clubhouse chemistry wasn't too good because he's like ran away from home. But, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you get your best results when human beings are comfortable, when they feel valued. And I feel like maybe that's an element we never talk about. And obviously it's hard to keep a team together in with free agency and with a limited payroll and all. And you have to have the right personnel in place for them to feel that comfort level because, you know, Terry Francona, he just seems like a wonderful individual to work under, honestly.
That's exactly the transition I was wanting to make here, is that it doesn't seem surprising that the Indians' fortunes changed entirely in the first season that Terry Francona came to manage the team. Like, you know, they went from almost a 70-win team to a wild card play-in game team with Francona showing up. I don't think that's entirely attributable to Francona, but I think it's silly to say that none of it is attributable to Francona and his history of success as a manager.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I guess we're touching on a lot of vague and hard to pin down concepts here, but I mean, how else do you talk about this team at this point? It seems like all of this kind of applies, even if we don't necessarily know how it applies or how much it applies or how, you know, what the catalyst for some of this stuff is. But it seems like you almost do have to resort to that. I don't want to call it like mystical aspect, but I feel like you almost, you know, you have to talk about this team in that regard, right? You win 21 games in a row. You know, you kind of deserve a little bit of supernatural conversation about your what makes you. You know what I mean? You can't just keep this to, oh, they hit and pitch well. That's
well,
boring.
Yeah, but It's a challenge to continue to create a team that hits and pitches well. And even if you do create a team that hits and pitches well, you're not always able to rip off a streak of 20.8 wins in a row, you know, provided how this game finishes out, maybe 21. That's the thing about this that makes it, you're right, it borders on the unquantifiable, the mystical, the legendary. But at the same time, I think we can trace back a couple of, you know, like we're saying, maybe they're not super easy to quantify in terms of raw numbers, but at least some principles that seem to be carrying through with this team. And one of them seems to be, like, we've talked in the past about the dangers of building around pitching. And I don't know if the Indians are really building around pitching in terms of spending a lot of resources into it. And I think that might be the differentiator between them and, like, say, the Braves or the Mets or something like that. But this is a team that I feel is carried by their pitching more often than they've been carried by their hitting over the last several years. I think this year they're offensively a little bit of a different team than they have been in the past. I mean, for goodness sake, Francisco Lindor is hitting 30 home runs. But I definitely feel like this is a team that was kind of built around their starting rotation. They've dealt with some injuries. They haven't always had all of their starters healthy. Danny Salazar is now a relief pitcher, which is, you know, if you would have told me that the Indians are going to be the best team in the American League, I would have guessed that Danny Salazar had a coming out party, didn't fall apart and get demoted to the bullpen. But they always seem to, I keep going back to the idea of their pitching staff, because from a development standpoint, they seem to develop a lot of successful pitchers, and it seems to be something where they're willing to stick with some of these guys. So I wonder if that building around pitching is maybe more of a, how much of a resources you put into it versus focusing on having that as being an important part of your team.
That's an interesting question. And I honestly don't know how to answer that, because it feels like right now we're kind of going through multiple culture clashes when it comes to the idea of how do you build a team and can you build a team around pitching? Because on the one hand, you know, the sabermetric principle has always been that hitters are safer and less volatile than pitchers. You know, you don't have,
right,
you don't have random elbow injuries pop up. So, you know, that's obviously a benefit. We're also going through a bit of a revolution with regards to pitching. And you see people kind of, I don't know if they're proposing that you go starterless now, but it seems more like people are buying into the idea that you don't need your starting pitchers to consistently work deep, that you can build from the bullpen out and, you know, get three or four elite relievers, which is, you know, always easier said than done. But if you can get a couple of elite relievers, you can shorten the game. You only need 5 innings from your starting pitcher, maybe even 4 innings from your starting pitcher come the postseason. Mm-hmm. So, you know, trying to answer this question with the backdrop of those two, you know, schools of thought kind of competing with the more traditional view that you build from the starting pitching out is really interesting. It's also, you know, the everything is always build up the middle, and the Indians, they're not really getting a lot of production behind the plate right now, but, and, you know, Zimmer's hurt. And
he was mostly Jason Kipnis hasn't been very good this year either.
Right. Although, you know, Ramirez has been playing second base, and Lindor, let me just put this out there about Lindor. I saw a tweet that he had hit 30 home. He was the youngest shortstop to hit 30 home runs or something like that since Alex Rodriguez in 1998. And just as a general rule of thumb, if you're doing things that have not been done since young Alex Rodriguez, you're probably pretty good. So, but back to the question at hand here. Here's the thing: like, the Indians aren't even getting like ridiculous length out of their starting pitchers. You
no.
want to guess what their average inning pitch per start rate is?
I would guess that it's pretty much near the median. I think Kluber kind of stretches it out, but then you've got Clevinger, who I know is not efficient even at his best usually, and Josh Tomlin is more efficient. But then again, they'd had those bad starts from Salazar. So I'll guess 6 innings.
It's actually 5.9, so as close to the 6 as you get. You want to guess how many teams are at 6 or over?
I would guess very few. I would guess maybe like 3 or 4.
It is exactly 3. And 2 of them are National League teams. One is the Nationals. The other is the Giants, which did not expect that, even with Smarja and Cueto. And for the record, the league average is 5.6 innings per start. So Indians have been above average, but it's not like a jaw-dropping amount. And maybe that speaks to something, you know, you talked about Kluber, and yeah, you know, he's great and all, but maybe they're really good at, you know, not asking their starters to do too much as well. I don't know if that's necessarily provable or testable, but
I don't know. It's a very interesting dynamic because you're right. This is a team that seems more carried by their pitching staff in recent years than their lineup, even though the lineup has, you know, improved appreciably and they're second in OPS in the American League. And I think they're like eighth in runs scored fourth in runs scored, eighth in RBI. So this is a very good lineup, mm-hmm. but you're right. They're still more like a pitching and defense kind of team.
Well, and the interesting thing about the bullpen is we've talked a lot about how great the Yankees bullpen has been over different points of this year. According to at least some metrics, the Cleveland bullpen has been better than the Yankees. It's got an ERA of 2.8 compared to the Yankees' 3.4. It's got 3.23 FIP compared to the Yankees' 3.43. But the Indians bullpen has only pitched 433 innings to the Yankees' 477, so they're used less. The one thing about the Cleveland bullpen is I've always found that it seemed at least like Terry Francona really likes to work his better relievers hard and leave the rest of the guys, you know, to do their own thing, kind of.
Right.
You've seen this year. This year seems to have been a little bit different. Brian Shaw is still so used. This guy, he must have a rubber arm because he's already made 69 appearances this year. Cody Allen's already made it to 60 games. So those couple of guys Francona really leans very hard on, but they've had such good performance, I can see why he's done it. It's worried me every year over the last couple of years that Francona tends to lean on specifically Allen and Shaw so much, but it hasn't seemed to hurt him yet.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like you're saying, he doesn't necessarily do that with the entire bullpen. If you look at their 0 days rest usage compared to the rest of the league, they have 95 appearances on 0 days rest. Well, league average is 89. And, you know, just for reference here, because, you know, there's not an opportunity to needle you about the Mets that I can allow to pass. The Mets lead the league still with 116. I mean, they are six ahead of the Marlins and eight ahead of third place Arizona and Milwaukee. So, yeah, the Indians aren't necessarily using all of their relievers on these 0 days rest patterns. However, when you break it down individually, like you said, Shaw ranks at least tied for fourth with Juan Nicasio, who I don't think I would have expected to be that high. And then Allen is 20th, and Allen is not necessarily like the most heavily used closer. But if you look at some of the names ahead of him, you have Corey Niebel, who is second in all baseball. Addison Reed, no longer a closer. He was third. Edwin Diaz, sixth. Felipe Rivero is eighth. Hector Neris, which there's a name I would not have anticipated being used that heavily, but he is 10th. And then you get Jim Johnson, Bud Norris, if you still count him, and then Allen. So among closers, even closers on – I mean, you can't even say those are all competitive teams. So, you know, Allen's usage is – he's definitely been used heavily. Let's not make any mistake about that. But it's not extreme among closers. So that's interesting to me. But you're right. Those two guys, they do get worked a lot. And you probably would have seen Miller up there too if he had been healthy all season.
In the last 5 seasons, the Indians have two of the three relief pitchers who've had the most appearances. Brian Shaw has pitched in the most games over the last 5 years with 368. Cody Allen has pitched in the third most games with 350. Would you like to take a guess at who was number two on the list? I'll tell you this: you probably won't get it.
Then just tell me. I'm not going to say.
No, he was a guy who was traded at the deadline this year. Now with the Dodgers, Tony Watson is the
really?
Number two guy in terms of games, not necessarily innings, but games pitched. As far as innings go, I think Watson actually has the lead, and then it's Brian Shaw at number two and Allen at four. Interestingly, in the number of games pitched leaderboard, there's another Indian who is in the top 20. And that's Joe Smith, who was with the Indians for the start of that run, then did his time with the Angels, the Cubs, and the Blue Jays, and now is back with the Indians. So that's kind of interesting to me.
You know what we really need? We need someone to study how these pitchers respond to the 0 days rest thing or all this heavy usage. You know who's not, like, I'm just looking at number one on this leaderboard, and I'm going to be honest with you, you wouldn't get it, but he pitches for the Royals. I don't even think he came up when we were talking about the Royals bullpen. I'm just going to tell you, it's Peter Moylan. He leads the league in 0 days rest. He's 38 years old, and a couple years ago looked like his career was over, and he's back, and I know his ERA has not really been pretty all season long, but it seems like for the most part he's been effective. And you know, it just amazes me that this guy has taken all that abuse, and here he is throwing, you know, 26 games without any rest, and he's thrown 17 multiple inning appearances. And I guess what I'm just saying here is, we have no idea how this kind of usage affects arms, do we?
No, not at all. And the thing about Moylan that's so interesting is he's a guy who's had that happen before, much, much earlier in his career. He had 3 out of 4 seasons back in the late 2000s where he pitched 80 or more games. So
wow.
That guy is a workhorse. So it's wild for him to be doing that again 10 years after throwing in what? His most was 87 games in 2009. So Peter Moylan, he's a hero.
Yeah, and while we're talking about these relief metrics and how they show the Indians bullpen, I just want to point out that McAllister and Shaw are 18th and 19th in the majors in multiple inning appearances. And if you go down the leaderboard just a little bit farther down, Botero is 29th. So
really?
The Indians have 3 of the top 30 in terms of multiple inning relief appearances. And then Andrew Miller, even though he's missed time, is 40th. He's actually tied with Archie Bradley, Blake Trinan, and a few other relievers who you may or may not be overly familiar with. So that's interesting. So as you said, you know, Francona definitely rides his top dogs heavily, and he also leans on guys like McAllister and Shaw to bridge innings, which I think we saw that last postseason. You know, Francona is not afraid to make an inning pitching change. And I think if you want to talk for just a second, I can pull up those numbers and see how they compare to the rest of the league.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'd be interested in that. The thing that is a question of, I don't know if it's good process or not, is if this is a good decision to do that, or if is Terry Francona playing to the strengths of his bullpen by doing this? Does he know that, you know, I can ride Brian Shaw as much as I want, he's not going to break? Or is this really kind of a luck issue where, a lot of times, if you have a manager who rides his relievers this hard, especially his high leverage guys, I'll tie it back to the Mets. We got furious at Terry Francona for doing this earlier in the season with the Mets relievers, with Fernando Salas and Jerry Blevins and Addison Reed, because they did not respond well to this kind of use. And so it could be something where maybe Terry Francona and the Indians front office is smart and they know that they have the right personnel for this decision. Or it could be that they're lucky and that this kind of heavy, heavy use just hasn't had an effect on these particular guys out of luck.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And I also think, you know, your team's performance kind of gives you that benefit of the doubt. Because the Mets, they've been bad, and, you know, frankly, their reputation is that they are, I don't want to say clueless, because there's a lot of talent in that front office. You know, Sandy Alderson is like the Moneyball OG, so it would be really disrespectful and myopic to say he's stupid or whatever. But, you know, the Mets have that reputation of being the Mets, whereas the Indians have the reputation, not only recently, but also in the past, of being a smart front office, being progressive and whatnot. So I think that comes into play. I will note that the Indians are actually just eyeballing it here. It looks like they're right around the top 10 and bringing a reliever in with a runner on base, as in they do it the 10th most often, let's say. And when it comes to bases empty, you know, putting a reliever in when the bases are empty, they are near the bottom of the league. So that's not necessarily saying that they bring a guy in to begin an inning way less often than the league average. And it doesn't also mean that they're making a lot more mid-inning pitching changes than the average team. But those are the numbers. And, you know, there's going to be reasons for that, you know, maybe,
sure,
I don't know, whatever you want to say. But, yeah, so that's an interesting pattern, and it's definitely an interesting set of philosophical questions on how they identify these relievers and arms and how they implement usage patterns. And maybe it's just as simple as the fact that, you know, they talk to the relievers, they see how their arm is feeling after they've worked, you know, so many innings, and they kind of build that trust both ways where, hey, we're going to put you in a position where you feel most comfortable. We're not going to ask you to do more than you're willing to do, but you got to be honest with us about how your body is responding. And, you know, I'm just going to put this out there too. So I mentioned this pre-show. I feel like the Indians and the Pirates, they are connected for reasons beyond the Neil Huntington tie. I feel like, you know, they're probably into similar stuff analytically. I would even say the Indians are probably ahead of the Pirates because, you know, they've been doing this longer. I feel like there's a very good chance that the Indians are on some medical technology or medical recording or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I realize there's, you know, some ethical and moral questions there, but I feel like they're probably way out in front on this stuff, and they probably are tracking their pitchers, especially in a way that maybe is giving them more answers than we would have or than a typical team would have. So I know that's kind of baseless conjecture, but just based on, you know, where they usually are with regards to analytics compared to everyone else. Because, you know, just to reference an art piece I did, when I did the article on where teams are getting their data, I talked to Vince Gennaro, and we were talking about how he feels that the gap between the quote-unquote smart analytical teams and the quote-unquote dumb analytical teams will continue to widen. And I was a little surprised by that, but in part because, you know, he said back in the Moneyball days, or even a little bit before that, it was the A's and the Indians. And he said the Indians just do not get enough respect for where they were back in 2002 and around that time as compared to the A's. And, you know, part of it has to do with the fact that Moneyball is, like, still a bestseller, whereas Dealing by Terry Pluto. I mean, have you heard of that book?
No, I had not.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a copy for the record. I can pull it out anytime you want me to pull it out. But, yeah, I guess that goes a long way. And, you know, I don't know. I guess they're getting their just due now, right? Because we're talking about them an entire episode, and we're trying to figure out how much of this is by design, how much of this is fluke, how much of this is luck, and we really don't have the answers.
No, we can remind everybody though that a good chunk of Moneyball was the interactions between Billy Beane and trying to hire Paul DePodesta away from the Indians. Obviously, he knew where to find the smart guy. And, you know, you can talk about Keith Woolner going over to the Indians relatively early in the sabermetric life cycle, and Russell Carlton working for the Indians and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's not as if there haven't been some quality sabermetric minds, even from the public sphere, that should make it a little bit more visible about what the Indians have done in the analytics sphere in the past.
Yeah, I mean, Sky Andrejczyk, we haven't even talked about him. Victor Wang, I mean, Think about how influential Victor Wang is because of his work with draft classes and, you know, prospect value and all. And here's the funniest thing. Like, when Victor Wang was a teenager, he was profiled in the New York Times by Alan Schwartz. Like, wow. That's how smart this dude is. When he was a teenager, he was literally profiled because of his analytic work in the New York Times by Alan Schwartz. And I pulled up the piece I wrote where I listed a lot of the people the Indians have hired from the public sphere, because, you know, you mentioned Woolner, I mentioned Andrzejczyk, and there's also guys like Clint Longenecker, who you're probably familiar with from Baseball America.
Yep.
I mentioned Purser earlier, I believe. There's just so many of them.
Didn't Max Markey do some work for them? I don't know if he still is.
I think
he
still does.
Yeah, okay. And he's, you know, one of the fathers of pitch framing and, you know, being able to actually be able to quantify some of that. So in addition to all of his other work that he's done. I mean, there's a huge amount of brain trust that has come through that front office. And you also see it in the executives that are part of that tree that seems to have now branched out into other front offices, which, you know, at times could be considered a little problematic, but it's certainly an example of how well regarded that Indians front office has been over the last few years, that they have, you know, different folks who've come out of that coaching tree now in Minnesota and plenty of other front offices. So it's not as if other teams aren't recognizing the amount of intelligence and the amount of capability that this front office has had.
That's a good point. Although I will note, because, you know, you talked about the problematic aspect, there was other reasons perhaps for the Indians tree spreading so far. And that's because of the supposed relationship between Mark Shapiro and Korn Ferry, their leadership search firm. And, you know, baseball actually terminated that relationship because it seemed like Shapiro had so much influence over the process. And that's not to take anything away necessarily from, you know, some of the executives who have
moved
off from Cleveland to take over other organizations. However, it does sort of,
color.
I guess I would say, yeah, it taints it, you know. Hmm. You wonder how much of this, and again, I'm sure they're all smart individuals. You don't get hired by the Cleveland Indians or hired by another team just because Korn Ferry happens to like your boss or whatever. But yeah, it's a very talented front office, and it seemingly has been for years. Although, yeah, at the same time, let's not ignore that the coaching staff
seems very good, and that the players themselves are talented. I mean, Francisco Lindor, with due respect to the Indians, like Francisco Lindor could go play in Alaska and he'd probably put up like a 5-win season. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so. he was a special talent even, you know, when the Indians drafted him. You can give a lot of credit to their player development staff, but he was a special talent from the jump. And there are other players on this roster who are, you know, extraordinarily talented, who have been all-star caliber players, who've been MVP caliber players. So no, this isn't meant to just say that the decision making in the front office is what caused all this. You know, there's credit for everything to be spread around, I feel like, from the players to the coaching to the staff. But we have a final in our game. The Cleveland Indians are now a 21-win team. They have the longest win streak in American League history. They have the second longest win streak in baseball history, only behind the 26-game winning streak of the 1916 New York Giants. That's unbelievable. That's
yeah, we haven't even talked about their best player yet. Are you waiting for me to say who the best player is?
Yeah, I was going to say, we've talked about Lindor. We've talked about Ramirez.
You know
we've
where
talked
this about is going,
Kluber.
Ryan. You know where this is going.
Who are we talking about?
A feller named Giovanni Urshela.
You are killing me. You are killing me, RJ.
If y'all remember, I am a Giovanni Urshela fan. Brian is not. Brian, are you ready to admit you're wrong yet?
Absolutely not. He is a great good luck charm. He's fabulous. He has a 47 weighted runs created plus this year.
He's just hitting to the score, Brian. He's trying to make sure the other team doesn't get their feelings hurt.
I mean, that's very sweet of him, but this is... Oh, you are killing me, RJ. Killing me. He did play today, didn't he?
I mean, they won, right?
He did. They did, and he did. I think he came in as a defensive replacement late in the game.
Let me just throw this out there, Brian. They are 42 now and 11. When Giovanni Urshela plays, they're 22-8 in his starts. I think we have our MVP.
You are killing me. This is making me so sad because while Giovanni Urshela came in as a defensive replacement for Yandy Diaz at third base, which, by the way, Yandy Diaz does not need a defensive replacement. This is purely out of this dumb luck, kind of the superstition that Giovanni Urshela must play. No, Yandy Diaz is the guy here. You gotta, no more Giovanni Urshela. I mean, keep running him out there as long as they keep winning. But if that guy makes a postseason roster, I'm gonna do something bad, I think.
You know what's going to be great, though?
What?
When Giovanni Urshela is the Mets opening day third baseman next year.
Oh, you are mean. You're a mean person, RJ Anderson. Why on earth would Giovanni Urshela be the Mets opening day third baseman next year when I'm dead certain that the front office is either going to assume that David Wright will be able to play or bring back Jose Reyes to play third base and make nobody happy?
Well, that's probably a good spot to end it. When we start talking about Jose Reyes coming back, that's probably a sign that the show has exhausted shelf life, you know.
We have to put that in the bylaws that anytime Jose Reyes is mentioned, the show ends. So you will be able to use that to your advantage when you want to record a 10-minute show one time.
You know this is going to end, right? You're going to say, my co-host, RJ Anderson. I'm going to say, actually, it's JR, as in Jose Reyes Anderson. That's going to be that. So anyway. Yes,
that'll be a short show.
Yes, you can find me at CBS Sports and CBS Sports, and you can find Mr. Grosnick at Baseball Prospectus. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, Giovanni Urshela is good for you, kids.